This is Houston. Say again, please.
Houston, we have a problem. We have a main bus B undervolt. We've got a lot of thruster
What's
activity here, Houston.
Now?
It just went offline. Oh, there's another master alarm, Houston.
I'm checking the quad.
Christ, there's no repress valve.
Maybe it's in quad C.
We've got a computer restart.
I'm trying to reconfigure the RCS.
We've got a blink light.
When these things fire, it doesn't make any sense.
We've got multiple caution and warning, Houston. We've got a reset and restart.
All right, I'm going in.
Welcome to Liftoff. It's a bonus episode. This isn't a real episode. Hi, I'm Jason Snell. He's Stephen Hackett. Hi.
Hey. We're here.
We're taking our off week. It's not been a fortnight, and yet we're here in the interim.
I don't know when this comes out, so maybe closer to a fortnight.
Oh, well, let's peel a layer off of the curtain. Do you do that?
Say
that we're recording them in between two other episodes of Liftoff. We're recording this special members episode. For being a Relay member, you get this episode of Liftoff. Hi, thanks. Yay.
Yes, thank you for supporting us. We're here today to talk about Apollo 13, not the mission, but the movie. 1995, Ron Howard.
Yeah.
It's pretty solid. So
okay, all right. Well, we're done here. Thank you.
You're the one with the entire network dedicated to
talking
media.
About movies.
Yeah, it's true. It's not my thing.
It's true.
So I believe we do opening statements if this were an episode of The Incomparable.
Well, if you're John Siracusa.
Well, I'm not, but my voice is scratchy, so I'm going to pretend that I am.
Your voice is so much better than the last time I talked to you. It's not
true.
Even funny.
It's true.
The Apollo 13. So yeah, 1995, I want to say. Ron Howard directed it. Ron Howard, not one of my favorite directors, but I think he does a really good job here. I feel like this is a... At moments, I think it's more like a Robert Zemeckis movie, although, of course, Robert Zemeckis' movie was Contact, which was made 2 years later. I wonder if Zemeckis talked to Ron Howard about this, because there's lots of stuff about there's the story part of it. There's the artifice part of it. I always say that it's like somebody dinged me on this on a podcast the other day when I said it's like people are like, oh, but artifice has a negative connotation. I guess it does. I'm really thinking about like it's the skill that goes into it, the artisanship of it, if you will. Like,
yeah.
There's things in this movie that are made like they shot a lot of this movie in a set that they built on the Vomit Comet that NASA uses to simulate weightlessness, where they take a plane up high up and it just flies these parabolas where at the top of the, as they're coming down, you're in free fall. And it's the only way you can simulate weightlessness in, without going to space. And they built sets on the plane. And so a lot of the shots where you see them weightless as if they're in space, they totally shot that in little tiny chunks, because it only lasts for a couple of minutes, I think, on sets built inside a plane that was diving to give them weightlessness.
Mm-hmm. It's actually madness. 25 seconds, according to this article on the AV Club.
Oh, it's only 25 seconds that each parabola is. So you get 25 seconds of acting, and then 25 seconds of waiting, and then 25 seconds of acting, I guess.
That's got to be exhausting.
Yeah. There are a few moments where, because there's a scene, and I guess we'll get into the plot later on, but there's a scene where Fred Hayes does throw up and he gets space sick. But there are a few other scenes that are the zero G scenes where I look at the actors' faces and I think they're not doing great.
Yeah,
it's the grueling space mission and all that. But also, I'm sitting there thinking they're probably all sick to their stomachs from having flown on this crazy thing. But and they fake it in a lot of other scenes. But there are some scenes where they are absolutely weightless, mm-hmm, in order to get you to buy into the fact that they are in space, and it works. That's the thing, is I look for the tricks now and I can't see them.
Yeah, I think there are only a couple of shots where I think they wanted to have that effect and they maybe hadn't shot, you know, in the microgravity situation.
Yeah.
And in which case they sort of move the camera, they sort of pan around the shot a little bit, so it's like, you know, Tom Hanks is standing still, but I feel like I'm the one moving, and
you can see they move. He floats the camera, and the actors kind of float a little bit. And I also noticed there are a couple scenes where it's shot in an interesting perspective, where it's like at an angle and further back, and you've got like Tom Hanks kind of wedged all the way at the back, tilted left, mm-hmm. and then you have Kevin Bacon in the front. And he's sort of like sitting and tilted right, and then the camera has this weird tilt, and it's moving a little bit. And I looked at that and I thought, well, you see, that doesn't require zero G.
Right.
That just requires artfully staging the shot to mm-hmm. make it seem like they're on different walls and that all the perspective is weird.
Yeah.
But it's a lot of, I mean, the amount, think about the amount of forethought. You talk about like doing... pre-visualization or sketches of all the shots, because they had to pre-visualize this, not like in the, like they, you know, it's like sketches. There's a word for that is escaping me now. Storyboards. That's it. Storyboards. Because they had to know exactly what shots they needed for zero G and the parts that they didn't need, where they could shoot those without being in zero G. It's just, it blows my mind. But they did a great job. And there is that scene where they're mugging for the camera and they're throwing, like, pens and sunglasses and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
That is, you could do, you know, in Gravity, they fake it pretty well. But in other movies, you can fake it. But I think it's amazing that this movie tries very hard not to fake it.
Yeah, it's the attention to detail that I think not only set this movie apart at the time, but rewatching it, this movie is now 21 years old, is what helps it hold up. I think that if this was all done in 1995 CGI, that it wouldn't look as good as it does of actual actors on actual sets actually floating around.
To be fair, some of the CGI here is, I think, just world class. And there's a story about that too. And I want to talk about the structure of this movie, because since it's based on real life, it doesn't have a normal movie structure. And even Ron Howard, who really likes applying kind of like movie tropes to everything, we need the people to root for, we need conflict, all these things. He's a very traditional storytelling kind of guy. Even Ron Howard, you know, you got to tell the story as it actually happened. So very early on, one of the biggest set pieces in the entire movie is the launch of the mission on the Saturn V, right? I mean, and it's like, I kept noting the things they decided to put in the movie and make a big deal of it, because you do want to have spectacle and action and excitement in this movie. They could have started this movie with them already in space, right? But it's like, no. We're going to back it way up. We're going to tell a story of them getting, you know, the mission and having these things happen and having to swap out a crew member. And we're going to show that launch, because it is the biggest rocket that humanity has ever built. And it's spectacular. But the way the story goes, people at NASA saw the movie when it was about to come out and said, I haven't seen that angle before. Where'd you get that? What footage are you using there? And they assumed that they were using stock footage in the launch of the Saturn V, because for space fans, it has details that you wouldn't. Unless you had seen the actual footage, you wouldn't know it worked that way. Like the fact that the fire kind of comes out of the bottom and then gets sucked back in. That's a thing that happens, and they show it in the movie. The fact that the tank is so cold because of what's inside it, that ice from the moist Florida air ices up the outside of the rocket, so that when it takes off, all of these ice shards, they shatter off and they fall down, but they're also being kind of like blown around by the rocket. And that's in the movie too. So people would be like, where'd you get this footage? And the answer is, it's not stock footage. They made all of it. And the giveaway is, of course, they've got a shot like from above as the rocket goes past, and they've got a crane shot that comes down as the gantries are disconnecting that don't exist, because you would die. But the level of detail on that in that sequence is mind-boggling. Like, it holds up today, even though this movie was made 21 years ago.
Yep. So do we want to dive into the plot?
Yes, the plot of Apollo 13. So, this really happened. We'll say that up front.
True story.
I read a sci-fi short story that I really loved in high school. That's about a time traveler who goes back in time from the future to, which was the present day, to the 50s to write pulp science fiction stories, many of which are true. And one of the stories that she writes that they cannot believe is actually based on when the people find out that she's a time traveler is based on something real is called Apollo 13. Hmm. They're like, that wasn't real, surely. And she's like, oh, yeah, that was real.
Yeah.
And I always think about that when I watch this movie because it is. Can we just say up front? There are things that happen in this movie that if you were reading a screenplay, you'd be like, nah, that's too far. That's too much. And they totally happen because this movie is pretty faithful. It's not exact, but it's pretty faithful to real life. There is, by the way, if you have the Blu-ray or the DVD, a commentary track that is amazing that is by Jim and Marilyn Lovell. Watching the movie made about the biggest thing that ever happened to them in their lives and commenting on what happened and what's right and what's wrong and what they like about their performances. And it is a rare thing to have the subject of your movie sit there and do a commentary track on the movie, and they did. So people should check that out if they like this movie. It's amazing. It's 1969, and Apollo 11 is about to land on the moon. There's a party at Jim Lovell's house. Jim Lovell has a bunch of he was the commander of the backup crew for Apollo 11. A whole bunch of astronauts are there, including Kevin Bacon. As Jack Swigert, who is detailing docking procedures to his date in a scene that makes me laugh and laugh and laugh. And they are looking at all of the memorabilia, the astronaut memorabilia in the Lovell's house. And Walter Cronkite comes on the TV, and it's time for Apollo 11 to land. All the astronauts try to wave them off and say there's just enough time to abort so that they aren't the first man on the moon. But, of course, Neil Armstrong is on the moon. I watched the original CBS broadcast of this. After I watched this movie, mm-hmm. and it's funny, they edited it to make it much more dramatic than it actually was, which is good because it's a movie. And the part that really made me laugh is in the original broadcast, Walter Cronkite doesn't quite get what Neil Armstrong said.
Yeah.
So he says, that's one giant step for man, one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind, and there's static and all of that, and it's not the clearest. And Walter Cronkite says, he said something there, I don't know what it is. And then there's like a pause for about 30 seconds, and somebody says something to him, and he goes, what I'm understanding is that what Neil Armstrong said there was, that's, and then he reads it out. And I thought, very nice of Ron Howard to just trim that, so it's like, Walter Cronkite totally gets it first thing. But so that's how we start. And I think that's an interesting thing to do with this, is to just lay it out there that this is not a movie about the first moon landing, but it's about these people, the people who came after them, mm-hmm. who had to follow in their footsteps. And I really like that. I really like that we see them all. That's just an unexpected perspective, right? See all the other astronauts watching on TV with the world as the people they know are landing on the moon.
Right. There's a mix all throughout this, especially with Lovell, about the excitement of walking on the moon and then sort of, I don't want to say jealousy, but like almost regret that it's not him, right? Like they're watching it and there's a moment where you kind of see him take a drink and you can picture him thinking about being there and being the first
and even just walking on the moon, because we know that something that is only mentioned in passing here is Jim Lovell was in Apollo 9 and they were the first people to circle the moon, but they didn't land. They were just testing out basically like can we get there, and they could, and then they came back in essentially the same trajectory that ends up happening to Apollo 13. So he wants to land, and of course that's, I mean, if you're talking about story structure, that's the tragedy of this story, is that he, although he survives and they find a way to get back to Earth, he never gets to walk on the moon, which was his dream. There's one of my favorite lines in this movie is in the scene following the moon landing. There, Jim and Marilyn are laying on their back patio in lounge chairs. It's you know, everybody else has gone home. The party's over. They've had a lot to drink at this point. Very clearly, they're looking up at the sky, looking at the moon, and he says, Oh, well, first off, she says something that is Lauren's favorite line in the movie, which is, "The house is a mess. We'll have to move."
Yeah, we have to sell the house. We can't clean it,
which is great. And then he's looking up at the moon wistfully, and he says, "Christopher Columbus, Charles Lindbergh, and Neil Armstrong." And I love the way that he says it. I love that moment because it's a recognition that this is an achievement for human history, and also it's a recognition that it's just a guy he knows.
Yeah,
on that list forever.
Yeah,
it's amazing.
In that same scene, there's another line by Lovell that I wrote down that says, "It's not a miracle. We just decided to go."
Yeah,
it's a good example of, you know, so much of this movie is pulled from transcripts, especially the conversations between the ground and the astronauts.
Yeah, all the Capcom stuff is from the transcripts.
Almost 100% of it is. Mm-hmm. There are a few tweaks here and there, but it is basically what was said. And so really the only place Howard has to tell his story is outside of that communication. And right. I don't know if this line was uttered or not by Jim Lovell, but it's a great little line showing, you know, this is something that is done by brute force, right? By engineering and guys with slide rulers. And we see all of them later in the movie.
It could also be something adapted from the book. So there's a book that is now called Apollo 13. It was originally called Lost Moon, mm-hmm. but when the movie came out, they republished it as Apollo 13, and it is Jim Lovell and Jeffrey Kluger is his not ghostwriter because he's, but you know, he was the, so they worked together on it. He's the writer and Jim Lovell's the astronaut telling the story. And I imagine they tape recorded lots of conversations and things like that to build this book. So it may be from that too, because this movie is suffused with sort of Jim Lovell's remembrances of this whole thing. It's officially based on the book Lost Moon. So it may come from there, but I love that. I love that moment too. The, you know, we chose to go, and we did it. It's like a moment of recognition of how amazing this whole thing was, that people just decided they would go to the moon, and then they did, and they succeeded. And mm-hmm. what an amazing thing that is.
Yeah.
So so now it's later, and they're getting ready to they're going to be on Apollo 14. So Jim Lovell is leading like a tour group of dignitaries through the vehicle assembly building. Where they're assembling the next the Apollo 13
with perfect timing, seeing it go together right as they're approaching.
Right? Yeah, yeah. This scene does a lot of work for the movie. It does. It there's a senator there who's actually, I believe, played by great horror film director Roger Corman. He's the senator. There's a senator there who basically says, "Well, you know, if there's an Apollo 14, like why are we even still doing this?" And Lovell's rejoinder is, you know, what if Columbus had landed in the New World and then just turned around and nobody ever went back, which is a recurring theme too, because this is a movie made by people who know that we went to the moon and then we didn't go back and we didn't go anywhere else.
Right.
And that's still the case today, 20 years after they made this movie. But it does serve that purpose. We get to see how impressive the Saturn V is before we see it launch. We get to see how impressive the vehicle assembly building is. And then what happens is that Deke Slayton, the head of the astronaut corps, comes out, pulls Jim Lovell aside, takes him away from the dignitaries, and we discover that our first sort of plot twist that you might put in your notes is like, is this really realistic? But it actually happened, which is Alan Shepard had problems with his inner ear that was always like a battle between him and the flight surgeons throughout his career as an astronaut. He gets bumped from Apollo 13 and they push Jim Lovell and his entire crew up. So he goes home and tells his wife, "I think instead of going to Mexico for spring break, well, I'm going to go to the moon." And they must immediately begin training. And so we end up with kind of a training montage sort of thing where they're doing practice docking, and it's Gary Sinise and Bill, which one is he? Paxton?
Paxton.
Bill Paxton. It's that one, not Bill Pullman. Totally different guy. Bill Paxton, Gary Sinise, and Tom Hanks are the three astronauts, and they're running tests. Gary Sinise shows his commitment to his craft by demanding that after a grueling test, when the backup crew, including Kevin Bacon, is about to go in, he's like, no, it wasn't perfect. I want to do it again. And everybody else is like, all right, let's do it, because that's a can-do kind of astronaut approach to things. This is also right after this is that'll come back later, is the point where there are two dream sequences in this movie.
Mm-hmm.
There's a dream sequence that Marilyn has, which is of Jim getting blown out into space in this, in an accident and dying. And later he has a dream sequence as they're flying past the moon's surface of him walking on the moon. So there's sort of two things in this movie that we see that didn't happen that are just in the imagination of people.
Right.
But definitely the family is anxious here. And Tom Hanks explains to his youngest son about the dangers, because the son asks about Apollo 1,
mm-hmm.
and, which is like the very beginning of the movie, is a brief montage of the Apollo 1 accident that killed those three astronauts. He says, no, we fixed the door that was the problem on that one. It won't be a problem. But of course, his wife is terrified now that she knows that her husband's going on the space mission.
Right. And I think the Apollo 1 thing is an important factor in this movie. They, I mean, even though assumingly if you're going to see this, you know it's real. Even though I read a comment that one of the early screeners rated it poorly because the ending was so Hollywood-like. It's like, well, actually, it was real. But
yeah.
The Apollo 1 thing is definitely a part of setting the stage that something can go wrong, right? And the little boy's asking. And they also use that as a time for Tom Hanks to sort of explain the hardware, right? So later when you see the lunar lander and all these things, you've seen it before as he's showing his son how it works. And it does a good job of moving that forward. But the Apollo 1 thing is definitely something that is clearly still weighing on the minds of the astronauts and of the staff. Even now, even, you know, several years later.
Yeah, this is if you were writing up, as I'm sure they did, the way you set the stakes for this story, you've got your parts that you can't really change, that are the facts. And then you've got the stuff around it. And this is one of the things you need to do, is you need to establish the stakes of, like, people have died, families are worried, We think of the success of the Apollo program, but you need to know. And they also have like the recurring thing of like his sports car dies. It stalls at the green light.
Mm-hmm.
And unlucky number 13, which he says, she's like, why does it have to be 13? And he says, it comes after 12.
Yeah.
Just totally like, I'm not a superstitious person at all. It's fine. But all of that is there to give you that sort of like, this is dangerous. You should be concerned so that when bad things start to happen, it's funny because this happened. And I would imagine a lot of people have seen this movie knowing what happens, although I guess a lot of people have seen it not knowing what happens too. So it's hard for me to imagine that people are like, well, I didn't even know that this was a thing, but now I'm going to watch this movie about it. But it's structured like you don't know. It's structured like a Hollywood movie with where you need to do the setup so you understand the stakes of space travel, which we could, you know, you and I understand that maybe, but for a general audience, it's like, we're going to tell this story, but we're going to play by the rules of Hollywood storytelling and set it up. So that's, and the emotional stakes of it, the fact that the families have to live through this, and mm-hmm. it's really scary.
Yep. So we now go back to NASA. We're now just a couple of days out from launch.
Yeah, a couple of days from launch, and Jim is brought in again to talk to Deke and the NASA administrator, I believe it is, who's played by Joe Spano, and they basically say, and the flight surgeon is there with his crew cut, and he's sort of a menace for the whole movie.
Yeah,
he says, well, the problem is that somebody got measles, and the problem with that is that Gary Sinise never got the measles, and they're concerned that since he was exposed to the measles, he's going to come down with the measles as he's, you know, running the command module while they're down on the lunar surface, and if something bad happened to him, they wouldn't be able to get home. So they don't want to risk having an astronaut with the measles. And so he's grounded, and they basically say, look, here are your choices, Jim. You can take Kevin Bacon instead, Jack Swigert, or you can all get bumped, and we'll just move the entire backup crew up, and maybe you'll get another mission down the line.
Right. This is already after the repeated comments that this is routine. Why would we keep doing this? So to push it back is also saying you may never get to go.
You may never get to go because who knows how long we're going to be doing this. So, you know, smash cut to Kevin Bacon, who's in the shower with a lady and he gets a phone call and whoops it up because he answers the phone. And he's like a total jackass. And then immediately it's like, yes, sir. Yes, sir. Yes, sir. And then he screams and realizes that he's going to get to go. Smash cut again to Gary Sinise looking like his puppy just died because he's been told that 2 days before launch that he's not going to go. And I like this scene because it's, you know, this is the military, right? Essentially, these are all military guys, even though NASA's a civilian operation. And this is Jim Lovell taking it. He's the commander of the mission. And he even says it was my call, which is sort of true, but not because he's like, I'm going to fight this and we'll go to Deke now. And Tom Hanks is like, no, it's my call. It's done. This is how it has to be. And it's I like this scene because it's so brutal. Like, it's just, it's very hard. You need to see that swing in emotion. But this is also one of those places where the plot, you would say, is implausible. It's like, really, 2 days before the launch, they're going to change people and not, like, just delay the launch or do some tests or whatever. They're just going to mix up the crews after all of this time practicing. And the answer is, yeah, that's what happened. Again. This is not a plot contrivance for the movie. This is what happened.
Right. So they had already been moved up one whole mission, and then it changes again. And they basically start training together.
They're like cramming.
Yeah,
for
it's
an
like
exam.
It's right before the exam. And this is one of the things that one of the few things in this movie that strikes me as a little out of place. And in the reading and in preparation for recording, it does seem like this was played up a little bit in the movie, that the stress that Swaggart wouldn't be able to pull off his duties. I mean, look, the guy's on the backup crew. Like, clearly he is trained and ready to go, but there's this tension, right? Even to the point where, like, Tom Hanks is, like, looking over his shoulder as he's trying to dock in the simulator and people are freaking out. He's like, I've got this, but it takes time, and really it's not till they are well into their mission in space that the three of them really begin to fully trust each other.
Yeah, I suspect that this is the thing in the movie that was invented. I think, and I think Lovell talks about this on the commentary track at one point, they're all astronauts. I'm sure that they are worried about fitting together as a crew and working seamlessly together, but I suspect that this movie overstates the concern that people have about Jack Swigert doing his job.
Yeah.
I don't really believe that Jim Lovell and Fred Hayes were staring at Swigert in the simulators, and that when they had a failure that is exactly the same failure that Mattingly had, that they'd be like, I don't know, kind of looks and everything like that. And that extends to when he stirs the cryotanks later on, that there's like some accusations and did you do something wrong and you're not our guy, that I suspect is drastically overstated from reality. It makes for good drama, right? But I don't think I suspect that the astronauts are all like, look, we're all professionals here. It'll be fine.
Right. So they launch.
They launch.
You spoke a little bit about it. I agree with
spectacular.
The CGI holds up. It's not.
Oh,
you missed
another unlikely plot development, which is Marilyn Lovell drops her wedding ring and loses it right before the launch, the day before the launch, the night before the launch, when she's taking a shower.
That's right.
Which also totally happened.
Yeah.
And is one more omen of like, duh, what's going to happen? Bad things are happening. It's bad luck. And it's a completely unlikely scene, but it's totally in the movie. This is also when they're getting they're in the white room with Günther Wendt, who's the real guy, who is the guy, and they have him like he's one of them's chewing gum and he has to spit it in the other guy in like the guy's hands.
Yeah,
and like, sorry about that. It's funny. And then they launch. Yeah, the huge special effect launch thing,
and it holds up. I mean,
it really does.
And looking at it, I felt that, yeah, you could tell it's a little bit older, but if you had told me it was 21 years old, I don't think I would have believed you. They do a good job.
Yeah.
They do run into a problem at launch with the second stage, one of the inboard motors cuts out early.
The fifth motor cuts out early. And we go through. So this is the segment where, in addition to having the spectacular kind of shots of the Saturn V taking off, we meet Mission Control.
Mm-hmm.
So we meet Gene Kranz, who's played by Ed Harris. He puts on his white vest that his wife has made him, because she always makes a vest for every mission that he's running. We meet some of the other people in Mission Control, and we will get to know some of them by name and some of them by job, and some of them they'll just be some of the cast. It's basically like another TV show going on, a movie or a TV show about the guys at Mission Control that we only see a little tiny part of, but it's all led by Ed Harris as Gene Kranz. But this is good, because then when that fifth engine cuts off early, we get to see them work this little miniature problem, which is setting us up for the larger story that's going to happen in the movie, where they kind of walk through it and end up saying, it's fine, we'll just burn them, the other four, a little bit longer, it won't make any difference. You see that in modern space missions that happens all the time, where there's a little weird glitch that happens, and they work around it, and it's still within the safety limits, and it's not a problem. And in fact, in this movie, Tom Hanks says, well, I guess we got our glitch for this mission.
Yeah, poor Tom Hanks. He didn't know what's coming.
No, he doesn't. He hasn't read the book
yet.
Well, he hasn't written the book yet. So they do, and we do get the we've talked about Apollo a little bit here, and at some point we'll probably want to break it down even further on an episode, because it's fun. But we go through all the stages of an Apollo liftoff. So they've got the second stage. They separate, and then it ignites, and there's the big kick, and then they get the I believe they get the third stage, and they do it's moved over very quickly, but they do the lunar orbit insertion, which I think is a time jump where it's sort of put together as, you know, one big launch, and they're on their way to the moon. I think the lunar orbit insertion, or the lunar Earth to lunar insertion, is like a few hours later when they do that, but it all just kind of runs together. But you see the complexity of it. You see them have to do the thing where they separate and flip the command mm-hmm. module and come back. And that's another one of those scenes where they're looking over Swigert's shoulder as he's docking.
Yeah.
And that's the thing that I did in the VR game, the Apollo simulator.
Mm-hmm.
That's on Oculus Rift. I did what they're watching Swigert do, and I completely botched it.
Well, but you're not an astronaut.
But it's a cool. I have not trained on it. It was my first shot. But I like that they go through all of the fun details of how these Apollo missions work. The fact that the limb was behind them in a housing, they had to pop it off, flip around, and then join the two together, and then pull it out, and then that was, and then turn around and go the rest of the way to the moon.
Yeah. Unlike Gravity, I think Apollo 13 does a better job at those details. I mean, one, Gravity is in a pseudo-made-up world. But Apollo 13 is not afraid to get down in the weeds for a minute and show you them programming the computer or using all these controls. And I think that's nice, and I think it adds a lot to the movie as a space fan, but it's something that just struck me, that I think a lot of movies would gloss over some of the mechanics in lieu of the story. But in Apollo 13, the mechanics and the story are so interwoven that it can't be separated.
Yeah, exactly. This is the movie also not only showing off how interesting the way Apollo works is, but also knowing that there's an audience that doesn't know how the Apollo program worked, and that this is a great opportunity for them to illustrate how, I mean, this, in some ways, this movie is kind of almost a historical document. Like, this is, what if we took a big budget Hollywood movie and were able to replicate kind of what happened? Because nobody, I mean, there's no movie about Apollo 11, because there's no, you know, the drama in it is all the kind of like the human drama of the fact that we did it. And the TV series From the Earth to the Moon does a great job of showing mm-hmm. the drama in making the Apollo program happen, and 11 is the culmination of that. But here, this is a story that's got all of the drama that you can apply to a motion picture, and inside of it you can do, because I know Tom Hanks is a huge Apollo program enthusiast, you can replicate what those missions were like, and give a broader audience a much better view of sort of like, this is what it was like. And so they do. They take the opportunity to not skimp on that stuff, to get the terminology right, to get the sets right. And there's even the level of detail where there's a scene, it is very rare, there is a scene where you can see that Tom Hanks is going to the bathroom in his spacesuit, attached to a tube, and then they dump it out of the spacecraft. You see them flip the switch for the urine dump and mm-hmm. turn the drain, and you see the CGI urine crystals beautifully kind of spew away from the spacecraft as they make a pun about the constellation Orion.
Yeah, that always made me laugh as a kid watching this movie, and it made me laugh again watching it.
It's real. That was a joke that the astronauts really made. But anyway, I like that it's like that level
dead
of detail.
Jokes in space.
This is what it's like. Let's see what else. So they
we got the TV thing.
There's a sad moment which again, all true, where they do their whole little TV broadcast, and the family is at NASA for this, and they look at like TVs are there, and they're not on TV, and the answer is that after Apollo 11 and 12, presumably, people are bored with astronauts going to the moon. They've seen it before, so they don't even show the live broadcast. And of course, in those days, if you weren't on the networks, you weren't on TV. There wasn't cable TV back then, so the networks just decided they weren't going to preempt their programming for astronauts. And the best so they watch this sort of bittersweet, and the guys from NASA say, we didn't even tell them, we'll tell them when they get back, and maybe they'll show some of it on the news tonight. But that's it.
What jumped out at me here is how these early astronauts, I mean, especially with the Mercury crew, but even here in Apollo, how well known these astronauts were to the general public and how much NASA expected out of them. We're like today, you know, or I guess not today, but in the shuttle program, I don't think astronauts were like household names. Maybe a few were. Like, I mean, there are a few kind of like rock star astronauts now, but you don't see them on television like you did then. It's just an interesting change to me that the way that NASA has moved away from some of that stuff. And I'm curious to see what they do. Like, if we end up sending a crewed mission to Mars, are those people going to be paraded all around the media? I bet they are, and I think that's good. It's just kind of an interesting change that I thought about in watching this scene.
Yeah, the times change, but I think some of the details change, but the overall idea doesn't. That a Mars crew is going to get, you know, they're going to get streaming TV stuff. There's going to be stuff like the SpaceX stuff we see, where they've got they're producing their own thing. They're going to do interviews. They're going to be on social media. You know, they'll find ways to promote it, right? But it'll be today's ways or 10 years from now's ways instead of what was, you know, what they had in the mm-hmm. in 1969, 1970. By the way, this I was a I was a fetus when this movie when this movie takes place. I was in utero when this movie takes place, because this is 1970, man. It's my year.
No comment.
So there's Fred Hayes, his wife is pregnant, sitting on the observation stand.
Fred Hayes, like, your dad?
That I went to that school with that kid, apparently. So that's it's pretty cool. This is where the accident happens. This is and in hindsight, and they say this at the end, in hindsight, this was fated before the crews were even selected, mm-hmm. because this is a fault. There's a fault in the wiring of one of the O2, the oxygen bottles, the pressurized oxygen bottles, that sparks when it's stirred, and it blows up.
Yep. Something so small, you know, this little component, this little break in this wire is enough to, I mean, really, it's amazing that these three guys came back.
It is, especially when they dramatize it, because, you know, at the time they didn't know. They just had like the noise and the shimmy. They were getting blown around and they could see something venting, but they didn't know. And at the very end of the mission, when they separated from the back part of the service module, that whole section, they took pictures and they could see the explosion. That scene's in the movie, right? They could see that. The only way that that this spacecraft is depicted in this movie after the explosion is because of that, like, that one picture. It tumbled away and they took the picture and then they landed and that was it. Mm-hmm. And so for the mission, the guys inside the spacecraft have no idea what the extent of the damage is, but we can see it, which I think is really interesting. Like, we get to see it explode and the camera kind of like zips inside the O2 bottle and you watch it spark and you see the explosion. I think that's an interesting way where we have more information than the astronauts do as the whole thing is happening. And because we've seen how quickly they reacted to that fifth engine cutting off, something they kind of understood, it's also really interesting to see what happens in Mission Control, where they want to get a handle on this, but they literally don't know what they're seeing. And I was thinking about not so much about Challenger as about Columbia, because there's about 30 seconds in this movie where all the data gets scrambled or lost and everybody in Mission Control is looking around at each other. And I thought the difference between Apollo 13 and like Columbia is exactly this, which is the data never comes back and they never hear from the astronauts with Columbia. And here the astronauts are still there. Something is very bad, but they get to work the problem. But I was struck watching it this time about that moment where everybody in Mission Control is just looking at each other like, what just happened, and they're all kind of terrified. And in fact, there's a great moment where Ed Harris has several great moments. Ed Harris has, who was nominated for Best Supporting Actor for this, where he's like, "Let's calm it down, one at a time.
Yeah,
let's work the problem, people." Right?
Yeah, he's got a line right in there too, when they're trying to decide if it's instrumentation, and he says, no, they're talking about bangs and shimmies. They're talking about getting knocked around. This is not just a data problem.
Maybe it's just our data is weird and there's a connection problem. And he's like, nope.
No. Listen to what they're saying.
Yeah, exactly right. Ed Harris, it's a great, he's got a lot to, it's kind of a broad, larger than life kind of character, but that's this character, and he is the quarterback of the team here. He is trying to get the best out of his people in bringing those guys back, and it starts right here where the astronauts also, I'm impressed, the astronauts are also reacting quickly. There is a perception, I think, sometimes that the astronauts are just remote control for people back on Earth and they tell them what buttons to push and stuff, but you see in Apollo 13 very clearly they are making decisions, in some cases decisions before the people on the ground realize those are the decisions that need to be made. Mm-hmm. Like when they start to imagine that they're going to need to use the lunar module as a lifeboat, they're already doing everything that's required to get over there before NASA radios up and says, this is what we need you to do. And in the immediate moments when this is going on, you can see that they're trying to figure out, not just communicate back to Earth, but trying to figure out for themselves, what do we need to do? Because something is very wrong here. And I like that these are very smart, well-trained professionals up in the ship, not just waiting to be told what to do from down on land.
Mm-hmm. So they get the lunar lander, which is Aquarius, set up to be basically, like you said, like a lifeboat. So they go in, they begin to power it up, and at the same time they need to shut down the command module, which is named Odyssey, to preserve what's left of its battery power for reentry.
Right.
They have to shut it down and move into a vehicle that was not designed for three people, was not designed for this sort of longer use. And that becomes another series of problems to deal with.
Yeah, this is an interesting point in the movie where they're solving one of the, they're not using the products as they're intended to be used, right? We've got two separate spacecraft tied together and one of them is having some serious problems. So let's use the other one. And so that's what they do, is they start moving over there. And I love this part of the movie because it is not something you see in movies or TV shows a lot, which is so many movies, especially big budget movies, there's a magical thing that happens that allows you to solve it, where somebody knows something that's invented in order to solve a problem or something like that. And here, so much of this movie is about human beings trying to reason their way through problems. And you see it, like Ed Harris draws on a blackboard. The guys in Mission Control are all talking to each other and working through the problems and making these tough decisions, including the one that is made by Clint Howard, Ron Howard's brother, who is great. This is a great little performance by him. He has played a lot of weirdos in a lot of movies, but this is a great performance as Cy, who is the Mission Control guy who has to make the decision. He basically says to Ed Harris, "We got to turn off the fuel cells." And everybody else is focused on how do we solve this and go to the moon. And he's the one who says, "They're going to die if we don't solve this. Forget about the moon."
Yeah.
And it's a great moment where Ed Harris has to be the one to say, "All right, is this it? And he's like, "Gene, this is my best option." He's like, "All right, let's do it." And then they have to get to the Capcom guy has to radio up to the guys, "We need you to turn off your fuel cells." And they're like, "Can you say that again? Can you be absolutely sure about that?" And they're like, "Yep, this is what you need to do." And you get that moment where Tom Hanks looks at the other guys in the spaceship and is like, "We just lost the moon. That's it." And it's brutal, but at the same time, it's in the context of we are trying to save your life.
Yeah, it's a good scene. And I like you said, I like the interplay between Mission Control and the astronauts. And sometimes it doesn't go as planned. And two examples jumped out at me. One, eventually, towards the end, they get tired of being monitored by the flight surgeon, who again is sort of this foil throughout the movie, and they just rip off all their sensors. And you know, he's freaking out.
We've lost Lovell.
Yeah, he's freaking out that Lovell died, and so they call up and they're like, "Yeah, I'm not wearing them." And then
I'm not wearing those sensors anymore. Yeah,
yeah. And the other two pull him off, and he just really has a cow. But there's another scene where the astronauts are arguing amongst themselves, and Houston calls up, and throughout the movie, the way the radio works changes. They can talk one-on-one, or they can be what's called a vox, which basically I gather is you don't have to like smash down the button. Like Houston can hear you. It's like an open line.
It's voice activated. So if you make noise, it sends it. Exactly. Yeah. Right.
So they're arguing and Houston calls up and Tom Hanks says, "Are we on vox?" And he says, "No." And he's very angry and he pushes down the button and he says, "You know, yes, Houston," in a very like respectful, calm way.
Right. Well, earlier he says something like, "God, what this ridiculous thing," and they're like, "Jim, you're on vox." I'm like, "Oh." And yeah. And you see Fred Hayes is like, "Sorry, Jim," because he's the one who's got those controls, and then he turns it off of vox, and then that, so it's on an open channel that he's saying that, and then later they do that. My understanding is that scene where they're yelling at each other is completely fabricated, that like Jim Lovell has said, "Nah, that never, we never would have done anything like that," but it is a good, you know, piece of the human drama to get the see into the state of mind of what were probably completely stoic astronauts. So I see why you would fabricate a scene like that for a movie like this, but it is a great moment where he just totally buttons it up when he talks to NASA. He's like, "Yeah, go ahead, Houston." So the accident is happening. Everybody's trying to figure it out. The families are getting called that something is going on. Ken Mattingly is so depressed. He's drinking beer, sitting in his house, and is so depressed about not being on the mission that he's watching like Dick Cavett make jokes about Swigert, and he's so angry, and he flips off his TV and takes his phone off the hook, and he flips off his TV as the Apollo 13 special report is coming on, and so he misses it, and so it takes him, like, they think he's dead at one point. They send people to go in his house and wake him up and say, "We need you in there later." But I like that he has to kind of come around because he's super depressed that he's not on this mission. And then, of course, you know, it ends up that they're in peril and he's safe on the ground, and he feels really bad, and he wants to do everything to save his friends. But at the same time, there's that moment late in the movie where Kevin Bacon says, "I wish you were here," and Garrison Keillor says, I bet you do."
Yeah, a little bit of a jab there both ways.
Amazing. So they get it under control, and they're in the lunar module, and then some time passes here because they're going to do free return trajectory. So they're going to go around. They're not going to turn around and fire the main engine because they're afraid the main engine bell got damaged in the explosion. They don't know, but they're concerned about that. So they're going to do the free return, where they basically, it's what Apollo 9 did. They're going to go around the moon and they're going to come back. And there's some nice scenes here where where Tom Hanks does his imagination of his landing. At one point here, they decide to do the free return though, and he lets the guys look at the moon. I guess that's a little bit later because he has his vision of being on the moon. But later when they fly past the moon, I like how Tom Hanks sort of steps back because he's already seen it. And it's so sad to me when they do that he's already seen it. He doesn't need to see it again. I mean, he looks and he takes pictures and stuff, but the other two guys are the ones who are really the tourists at the moon. Because they haven't been there, but Jim Lovell is here to land on the moon. That was why he was on this mission.
Right.
He's flown around the moon before.
And why he elected to break up his crew to do it.
Yeah, exactly.
It is sad, but I think that it is portrayed well by Hanks here that he can pull off the... He's sad about it, and he's disappointed, but he's also looking out for his crew and giving them an experience that they won't have again. And I think that's a nice balance, and I think it comes off as genuine on screen.
This is also around in this point. They do one of the mechanics of this is they pass behind the moon and they lose radio contact with Earth. And since they're in such danger, this always happens when this goes on. But it is a moment that it's a moment of isolation for them. But also it's a moment where they are so close to the moon and they're looking at the far side of the moon. And it's a moment of beauty for them, but it's a moment of sort of terror for everybody else because they're worried about them and they haven't heard from them. And then they come back around the other side and it's fine. Hanks thinks about walking on the moon. He does his thing at the beginning when they're on the lounge chair, he puts his arm out and his thumb covers the surface of the moon. And he knows that his people he knows are on that surface. And then here, as they come around and see the Earth again, he does the same thing. He sticks his arm out and puts his thumb over the Earth, which is a nice little touch.
Yeah.
A Ron Howard touch, I think.
So they come around the moon and the conversation and the plot move towards getting them back. And a couple things come up. One being that Swaggart has been doing math, saying that, our angle is wrong. They haven't told us that they don't have a plan yet. He doesn't freak out, but he voices concern that Mission Control may not being honest with them completely.
Right. Which is, I think, legitimate, right? Like, if they don't have an answer, they're not going to tell them, well, forget it, give up. They'll just not say anything. So problem one is their angle's not right. Problem two is they don't have enough power, so they have to shut down all the power in the LEM, too, including, like, the heater. So they're going to get really cold. Problem three is they don't know if they're going to have enough power left to turn the service module or the command module back on when they get close. And then the fourth problem is the CO2 scrubber to take the carbon dioxide out of the air that they exhale in the lunar module was designed for two guys for like a day. And instead, it's been used by three guys for many days. And the scrubbers in the command module are not the same shape. Again, you couldn't make this stuff up, folks. Are not the same shape and not compatible with the scrubbers in the LEM. So all of these things are happening kind of simultaneously where they're shutting things down on the spacecraft and being kind of miserable. There's guys in white shirts with ties who are trying to figure out how to get the square peg in the round hole for the carbon dioxide scrubber,
literally.
Which is a bunch of great scenes with that where they like literally have pulled out all of the objects that are on the ship and they put them on a table and say, you got to make this work with this using this. And it's so great and completely real. Lauren's grandfather actually worked for a contractor that did the scrubbers and was involved apparently at one of the that contractor that they got everybody up and brought him in and they were trying to figure out how to adapt the scrubbers. Not much to the story other than that suffice it to say everybody who was working on these devices was working to save those guys. And so all of these, meanwhile, Marilyn Lovell's really angry because the press is now finally interested in her husband's mission now that his life is in danger and tells them to get off her lawn. That happens.
Yep.
It's a good scene for Kathleen Quinlan.
Yeah.
The astronauts are now bored and cold. Their tape player's battery has run down.
That's a good scene. It's floating kind of end over end as the tape slowly just slows down.
Slowly runs down. And they're all pretty run down too, contemplating that whether they're going to make it or not. Fred Hayes is sick. He's running a high fever now, so he's even more miserable. So we get to see some camaraderie there, but there's also that this is where we get the, you know, Kevin Bacon is a little bit of an outsider. They haven't been training with him. You get that scene where it's like, are we on Vox? No, we're not. We're doing fine. And then back on Earth, you know, they come up with a plan for the scrubber, and Ken, that's Ken Mattingly. Does he? No, that's the regular guy, radios it back. Ken comes later with a power up sequence. Mm-hmm. Here they bring the tube, and everything to Mission Control, and the astronaut who's at Capcom starts radioing up the instructions, which are great. And the first one is like, do you have the manual there, the mission manual? It's like, yeah, we got one here. It's like, well, rip the cover off. And they're like, well, that won't be a problem.
Yeah, done. Rip.
Which is very funny. And then later, I think my favorite part of that whole process is, and you miss it, if you blink it, you miss it, which is that Tom Hanks takes one of his socks off. It's a great moment. I don't know if you caught it, where they're like, and a sock, and he takes his little booty off. He pulls the sock off. He brings up the sock and puts his little booty back on, because one of the things they need to make this thing work is one of his socks. It's amazing. They rip one of the bags and they radio back, yeah, we ripped that bag. And they're like, what did we do? And they're like, okay, I think you've got another bag. And they go and get the other bag. It's very tense, but also kind of funny that they're just trying to hack this thing together. They plug it in and it totally works. And they can breathe again, which is great.
It's good. During this time, we also have we have kind of two more things going on. We have Mattingly on the ground working on the power-up procedure.
Yeah, this is the payoff for him saying, I didn't do that perfectly. I want to go back in there. Now he's like, I want it cold and dark in there. I'm not going to sleep because they're not sleeping.
Give me the brand flashlight they have. Like, a guy hands him a flashlight. He's like, no, that's not the one they have up there. Give me the one they have.
Right. He wants to be in their minds trying to figure out, because his goal here is, what switches do I flip in what sequence to get them to never draw more power than is available in the batteries? Because if we can't start this all up, then it's not going to work. Like, we got to warm up the parachutes. We got to do, I mean, there's lots of things they've got to start up, but they're trying to find the right sequence. And, you know, you walk through all those different options. It's like, there's millions of different ways to do it. So he's very skilled. I like that too, that it's not like it's just the guys. Again, he's not just a monkey pushing buttons. He's been training in this thing a lot. He knows what all the systems are. And so he's trying to think like them, but also knowing what he knows, like, how can I flip this in the right way? And they're, you know, all the guys are in the white shirts and the ties are being supportive and coming up with ideas and things like that. And we get to sort of drop in the middle of that for a little bit and see them trying very hard to work the problem. They get frustrated. The master alarm goes off. It didn't work. And then there's a great moment. There's that moment of realization where they realize, hey, they're still tethered. Normally when they come back, they've got the limb until they, when did they eject the limb? Did they eject the limb at the moon, or did they bring it back to Earth and then eject it? I think they probably brought it back to Earth.
I think they bring it back.
So anyway, so they've got it attached and they're like, oh, that has a battery in it. What if we reverse the flow of our connection and it gave us some extra power? And they're like, oh, well, it wouldn't be great, but it might be enough. And they're like, let's try it. And then flip, 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 flip. And there's a great moment. That's kind of understated, where everything's on and it's just sort of silent. And they're like, well, Ken, what's going on? And he's like, we're up. And they're like, oh, the alarm didn't go off.
Yeah,
it worked. It's a great moment. It's like, we did it. It's great. And then that's when he goes, and he's been just doing this. And they get frustrated, and they're like, where is the power-up procedure? And they're like, Ken's working on it. And they're like, oh, okay, Ken's working on it. And then he comes into Mission Control and takes the headset from Capcom and says, all right, guys, I got your, this is the, I bet you wish I was up there, Swigert. I got your procedure. Let's walk through it. And he walks them, and Swigert in particular, through the power-up procedure to get the ship ready to go back And it's great. That's like what I think of when I think of this movie is stuff like that.
Yeah. We also have a burn in here. They end up using the motor.
Oh my God.
That is supposed to be at the bottom of the lander. And all, so in this, yeah. You see little conversations between NASA and their vendors, right? So these other companies are building this hardware.
There's a character in this movie called Grumman Man, and he's the guy who is the representative of Grumman who built the LEM. And all he does is stand there and say, it wasn't built for this.
Yep.
And they get so frustrated with him. They're like, yeah, you're saving, maybe you save your job here, right? But it's like, he has nothing good to say. It's like, it's not under the warranty. Well, but can it do it? He's like, it's not designed to do it. Shut up. Oh, it's so great. But
yeah, I think the line is, I don't care what it was designed to do. I care about what it can do.
Yeah. And the Grumman man is not helpful in any way to that. But they do this terrifying burn, right? Because it's not meant to do it. It's the LEM. They don't want to use the service module engine because they think it might be damaged. So they use the LEM engines to do a burn for like 50 seconds. And it's like just the way they do it, too. It's just like keep your target on the Terminator on the Earth's edge right here. Just keep it there and fire it for 50 seconds. And they fire it and it's like, whoa, and it's going all over the place. And it's so tense. Mm-hmm. It's like, I don't think that they are doing a very good job of this. And they figure it out. But it's pretty funny that it is. I think that may be the tensest scene in the entire movie, actually, is that scene. It's not going well for them.
No, and it's, you know, they don't have a computer. They don't have the guidance they normally have.
Yeah, they're gonna like turn on the computer. And they're like, nope, you got to do this by
Reaches over, and he's like, yeah, I'm trying the computer. Like, no, don't do that. And
close one eye and look out the window and fire this thing.
Well, and it puts these guys back in their job as pilots.
Yeah,
right. That these guys all came from like the elite pilots of the United States military, and it is saying, hey, you guys are gonna have to do this old school, and they do it, and it's I agree with you. I think it is the most intense scene in the movie. Even the scene where the explosion takes place, it's more chaotic than intense, I think. But this scene, like, everyone is yelling, and Fred Hayes has to be involved, who looks like he's dying. It's an intense moment.
Another moment here that I really love in the humor side of it is Jim Lovell's mom, who we've seen before, because she's there when they're watching TV and they have to explain to her that, you know, Jim's not going to make it to the moon. But they're going to try to come back. And it's actually a great line where they're trying to think, they think she's not all there. She had a stroke or whatever. But Jimmy's going to try to, you know, Jim's going to try to bring him back. He's going to try to bring him back alive. And suddenly she gets this like steel, and she looks and says, look, if they made, what is it? It's like,
if they could get a washing machine to fly,
my Jimmy could land it.
Yeah.
It's so great. And then the best part is they're going to watch to see if they survive. They're going to watch the splashdown. And they've got her in like a side room. And Marilyn comes in and says, okay, these guys work with Jim and they're going to watch it with you. And she's like, just, you know, she's old and confused and just take it easy. And they're like, we got this. It's fine. And she goes in and introduces him. And it's like, oh, these guys work with Jim. This is Neil Armstrong and this is Buzz Aldrin. And she says, oh, do you know my Jimmy? Do you work with Jimmy? She has no idea who they are. Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin. She has no idea who they are. It's adorable. I love that. I love Jim Lovell's mom.
I want to say something real quick about the news coverage. And so I think Ron Howard does a good job at, instead of just having exposition taking place within NASA, where it'd be a little unnatural, like one engineer saying, we have to do this for these five reasons, where all the people in the room know that.
Yeah, and there is some of that where Ed Harris does some of, like, he explains what a free return trajectory is. It's like, yeah, they know. They know, but we don't know, so you have to say it.
So Ron Howard falls back to news coverage. So when they're talking about they've got to do this burn, really what that's about is the angle of attack back into the atmosphere. And so they break to some science correspondent, you know, holding a basketball and a flamethrower and all this stuff, explaining what's going on to the general public. Well, in the movie, we are the general public. And so I think it's nice. I mean, you have to do some exposition in movies like this because there's technical information you just have to get across to the audience. I don't have any real big complaints about how they do it. You know, you have, I think there's a scene where Jim Lovell's wife is on the phone with NASA yelling at somebody about something she has seen on the news. And just, I think they work it in pretty nicely.
Yeah, there are moments where it's very much like, oh, you cynical journalists, you're just interested in this because there's danger and there's a press conference where they're asking like, oh, but are they totally going to die? And they're like, ah, let's do it. You can see, you know, this is the same thing. The Martian does this very, very similarly when it covers the press stuff. The guy with the flamethrower, that's Jules Bergman. That's actual archival footage of Jules Bergman from ABC News doing that stuff, which is pretty funny that they worked all of that in. Like they have used as much. There's no fictional, like Lane Smith plays a fictional anchorman in From the Earth to the Moon from a fictional network because they have lots of stuff that they have the press do in that they have to fake up. But for this, they basically use archival footage. There are a couple points where they had Walter Cronkite basically do an impression of himself and record some stuff at the very beginning, especially. It's Walter Cronkite sort of reading some stuff written for him in his voice that segues into the CBS coverage of it. But mostly they're using Walter Cronkite and Jules Bergman. They're using real journalists from that period with the real footage of that period. It's not like they brought actors in to be that, which is kind of cool. And we're at the end now. They power up, which is exciting because it's there's lots of condensation, and he says it's like driving a toaster through a car wash. They don't know if it's going to work.
That's a good line.
And they have to move ballast to the ship because they were supposed to have moon rocks. They're coming in shallow, and there's that scene where they say they're coming in. You know, they're coming in pretty shallow here, and if they're too shallow, they're just going to skip off the atmosphere and go back into space. And Gene Kranz says, "Is there anything we can do about it?" And they're like, "Nope." And they're like, "Well, then we're not going to tell them. We're just gonna let it go." And everything is melting now. It was cold up there, but everything is sort of melting and dripping on them as they get ready to go. They eject the service module, and they can see the site of the explosion, and they describe it. We've been seeing it all along, but they can see it. They let go of the LEM. And they're in reentry. And at that point, they have like the montage of like the Pope tells everybody to pray for them, and they buckle up and let go of the limb, and then they enter what they say is 3 minutes of silence before they splash down in the South Pacific. Oh, there's also another completely unlikely thing that happens here, which is that there's a typhoon warning on the edge of the landing zone.
Yeah.
Just to amp up. But again, you can't make this stuff up. This is actually what it was. And you can actually, when they look out at the Earth, you can see the typhoon off in the distance. Like, oh, geez, there it is. This is a scene when they're waiting the 3 minutes. This is a scene that's basically real time, that they make us wait with the people. And everybody is worried. They say goodbye. They begin their reentry. We see the heat shield and all of that. And then what Ron Howard does and what the screenplay does is take us away from them and put us in the shoes of the people on the ground and makes us wait. And, you know, Marilyn is watching from their home on TV. The kids are there. There's a priest behind her, played by Ron Howard's dad, by the way. You put your dad and your brother in the movie. Why not? And they say 3 minutes, so they have a countdown for 3 minutes, and then they'll know. And then 3 minutes go by, and we all sit there and wait. And then another minute goes by, and everybody's like, oh, geez, this is the end. And then, like, another 30 seconds go by, and we see the parachutes and hear Jim Lovell's voice come over the radio and know that they're fine. Which is basically what happened in real life. That's how it went. Because they were coming in so shallow, the reentry took longer than expected.
I really appreciate the real time nature of this part of the film. I think it does a really good job of putting us in the shoes of the world. Right, you're watching that timer click down, and then it starts clicking back up from zero, and you see the dread and the realization start to sink in, and just when it does, is when that thing pops out of the clouds.
Yeah. Yeah. And this is, I can see how this would be the complained about it's like too Hollywood of an ending. And yeah, I mean, Hollywood does this same trick, right? Which is they make you wait and think that they're not going to come back. And then, of course, they are. But this is the actual drama of these kind of events. And so I don't have a problem with it. It is funny because this is sort of a movie cliche. But this movie gets a lot away with a lot of movie cliches because it's very closely based on the truth. And so, you know, you can't. Like I said, you can't make a story up like this with all of these elements. It would be too far, too much, too corny. But it's true, and so that gives them license to do that. Mm-hmm. And I'm fine with that. And you get the beautiful shots of the capsule coming down with the big white and red parachutes on it, and they're you know, now they're heavy and they're laying in the capsule, and they get pulled out. And there's a moment where they're getting ready to go, where he says it's going to be 80 degrees in the South Pacific out there. And they've been freezing for the last 2 days, and they're like, oh, 80 degrees. And Tom Hanks signs off. He says, the rescue crew is here, and this is Apollo 13 signing off. And everybody applauds, and Ed Harris, there's like a great crane shot of Ed Harris in the mission control, looking proud of what they've done. We skipped over, there's a moment where they're talking during the wait about with a guy who's like the representative of the Nixon administration there, about like what do they do if they die, and this would be the greatest tragedy in NASA history, where Ed Harris overhears them and says, on the contrary, I believe this will be our finest hour. So great. It is so like movie corny on one level, but another level it's like, that is, you know, just like failure is not an option. That's Gene Kranz, and that was like the NASA attitude mm-hmm. that they're getting across there.
It's good. And there's a little Easter egg right here at the end. They meet Jim Lovell on the ship.
Yeah, the captain of the USS Iwo Jima, who salutes Lovell when they and the others when they return, is Jim Lovell. The real Jim Lovell is the captain of the Iwo Jima. And he shakes Tom Hanks's hand and pats him on the shoulder. And they chat, and we don't hear what they're saying because the music is up. It's a nice Easter egg. I want to say a word about the music. James Horner did the music for this, I think I really like the score. I like his work. He did the music for Star Trek II and Star Trek III. I think he does a good job here. The end credits have the same themes with a choir singing them, and over the end credits, you'll be like, oh, yeah, this is the guy who's going to do Titanic. But in the movie itself, before the credits roll, I think he does a really good job. I really like when Chris Breen was when I asked him to do our theme music for this, I actually said, you should listen to Apollo 13. And I think his impression of that was that it was more, just the kind of the rousing part of like when they launch. But at the beginning, it is... there's like the little there's like a little drum, but it's actually very much like Chris's theme for liftoff. It's a much more kind of quiet and contemplative sort of thing, and I like that about it. That it's got its moments where it's super uplifting and exciting, but it's also got those really quiet moments where it's just like the single horn playing and with the drum going in the background. It's good stuff. So I love this movie, Steven, is what I'm saying. I love this movie. I've seen it many, many times, and I think it's a really good space movie.
I do too. I hadn't seen it probably in 5 or 6 years, and it was the first time my wife has ever seen it. So we watched it the other night together, and you know, I turned to her afterwards, like I was like, "What do you think?" And she was like, "I mean, I know that it's all true. Like she knew the story before going into it, and she said she was completely captivated during the movie that." It does such a good job of pulling you in. You almost forget that these are all real men and women in a very real, very dangerous situation. And I think that speaks volumes about the film. And I'm right with you. I love it. It's one of my favorite space movies, one of my favorite movies in general. And it was a lot of fun to revisit it. It's good.
Yeah.
It's good.
I'm glad. I mean, I think in the end, what this is a story that is the perfect story for a movie. It's not quite the structure you'd like, because you like your big special effects set piece is the launch more than anything else. But right, so the structure is a little bit weird that way because it is real life. But it's ready made for a movie. And then I think this is one of those cases where somebody who's got really good mainstream Hollywood crowd pleasing instincts, like Ron Howard, and we can debate Ron Howard at some point because. He's got his issues because I feel like he goes to this well a little too much, like too Hollywood, too, you know, let's give me some people to root for and we'll have the, you know, we'll go take the plot from A to B to C. But it's a perfect match here of somebody who's got the earnestness and also the movie making ability of Ron Howard to take this story and make it in this way. It's a great thing. And then you get Tom Hanks in the lead, who was coming off of, I think, two consecutive Oscar wins for Best Actor when he made this movie, and he was nominated and didn't win for this one. And this movie was nominated for Best Picture. I mean, it's like it's a good combination of people and story to make a movie about the space program that really gets across what the Apollo program was all about and who these people were. And it was, like Gene Kranz says here, it was their finest hour. You know, yes, the landing on the moon was the crowning achievement, but this was their finest hour in pulling together and showing that they could solve these problems and bring these guys home. So it's I'm very glad that this movie exists. There are other movies like The Martian and Gravity that I think do a good job of showing a lot of things about what we love about space and what can be potentially great and also terrifying about being on the frontier and space exploration. But Apollo 13 has the added advantage of being completely, you know, with a footnote here and there, real.
Totally agree. It's good. Thumbs up from Liftoff.
Shocker, Space Podcast enjoys Apollo 13.
Breaking. Well, cool. So
yeah.
Thank you, Jason. Thank you to our members. If you are listening to this and you're not a member, you can learn how to
that
do
happen?
That. You're sneaking around. Relay.fm/membership. Thank you to people who support not only our show, but all the great shows at
great
Relay.
Shows. Yes.
As a co-founder, there are sort of all my shows, and we really appreciate it. It's a lot of fun making this show and making the other shows. Jason, you and I both have many shows on the network.
So many.
And it's a real treat to be able to do this.
Yeah. Yeah. So thanks to everybody. And, you know, next birthday month, we'll do it again on something else. But thanks for supporting our network, and we hope you enjoyed this episode, this bonus.
All right. Talk to you soon, Jason.
Adios.